Morning, Kevin.
Maria, good morning, Nick.
Good morning. My name is Carol Ventura, Executive Director of Rhode Island Housing. This is the January 13th, 2021 meeting of the Rhode Island Housing Board of Commissioners Credit Committee. CJ Rotella, the Director of Technology for Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this telephonic meeting.
Good morning. This meeting will be recorded and available for review on Rhode Island Housing's website within 3 to 5 business days after this meeting. Except for the Credit Committee, Board of Commissioners, and specific Rhode Island Housing, all callers will be muted during this meeting. To prevent any feedback and background noise, we ask the commissioners and participating staff to please mute your phone if you are not speaking. During the meeting, if anyone is having technical difficulties with audio or reaccessing the call, they should call 401-457-1240. Thank you.
This is Carol Ventura. Nicole Clement, General Counsel for Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this telephonic meeting.
Thank you, Carol. Good morning, everyone. This is Nicole Clement. Pursuant to Executive Order 20-46, extended by Executive Order 21-01, and as may be further amended or extended, this meeting is being held via teleconference. Members of the public can visit the Rhode Island Housing website to view the agenda and information on the actions being taken. In the event this teleconference is interrupted, we will stop the meeting until we can reconnect and audio is restored. I would now like to provide some additional guidance to our committee members and staff as they participate in this meeting. Committee Chairman Kevin Orth will preside. Please remember to state your name prior to speaking and mute your telephone when you are not speaking. And now I will turn it over to Committee Chairman Orth to call the meeting to order. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Nicole. Good morning, everyone. I would now like to call a meeting to order, and also thank you for attending. We don't have any agenda items other than the meeting minutes from our last meeting to vote on, but do have a number of discussion items. So again, very much appreciate your attendance and participation today. Carol, would you please conduct a roll call of attendance?
Sure. Thank you, Commissioner Orth. I will now conduct a roll call of members of the Credit Committee, Board of Commissioners in attendance, and staff of Rhode Island Housing. Chairman Nicholas Ritzina.
Here.
Commissioner Kevin Orth.
Here.
Commissioner Liz Tanner.
Here.
Commissioner Maria Barry.
Here.
Staff of Rhode Island Housing, James Comer.
Here.
Lisa Primiano.
Here.
Tara LaChapelle.
Here.
Eric Shorter.
Here.
Christine Hunsinger.
Here.
Ann Berman.
Here.
Leslie McKnight.
Here.
Michael DeCaro.
Here.
Eric Alexander.
Here.
Nicole Clement.
Here.
CJ Rotella.
Here.
Commissioner Orth, the roll call is complete.
Great. Thank you, Carol. Now I'd like to introduce action item number one, which is the approval of minutes of our Credit Committee meeting held on November 10th. May I have a motion to approve?
So moved, Liz Raybarry.
I heard Maria. Was there, Liz, were you in there as well?
I'll be second today. We'll let Maria be first today.
Okay. Great. Thank you. I'm assuming there's no discussion on that. Nicole, would you please conduct a roll call vote?
Thank you, Commissioner. This is Nicole Clement. When I call your name, if you are in favor of approving the minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on November 10th, 2020, please respond by saying aye or opposed by saying nay. Committee Chairman Orth?
Aye.
Chairman Rezinas?
Aye.
Commissioner Tanner?
Aye.
Commissioner Barry?
Aye.
The vote is unanimous. The motion passes. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Nicole. Again, we have no other transactions or other agenda items. It's solely discussion. So the first discussion item is to review the pipeline report and I think specific emphasis on Lippitt Mill, Barbara Jordan and any other transaction that has had some issues in completing or getting started. And with that, Eric, would you please lead the discussion?
Great. Good morning, everyone. Happy New Year. Again, this is Eric Shorter. I'll start my comments just giving a quick overview in terms of where we are in our pipeline. Typically, what happens at the beginning of the year, we spend probably half of the first quarter kind of sourcing transactions for the rest of the year. We're off to a pretty good start. We have 4 to 5 tax-exempt 4% preservation transactions in the queue under underwriting, as well as 8 taxable finance transactions that we're starting underwriting on. And we look forward to bringing that in the coming months, those transactions in the coming months. But I'll spend the remainder of my time really focusing on tax credit, 2021 tax credit applications, Barbara Jordan and Lippitt Mill. So let me start with the 2021 tax credit application. We received 11 applications requesting over $13 million in tax credit requests. Over $11 million in home requests and $14.2 million in housing trust funds in this round. Again, like I mentioned, we had 13 proposals all over the state, a lot of diversity there. Had four transactions in the capital city, one in East Greenwich, one in West Greenwich, one in Woonsocket, Tiverton, Coventry, Scituate, and Lincoln. Again, totaling 11 proposals. So that's 4-1. We have currently available to us in 2021 tax credits. We have approximately 2.7 available in tax credits. We received 3.2 million in tax credits for this year, 2021. But we committed 495,000 for Paragon Mill last year. So leaves us with 2.7 million in tax credits for this round. So that's the tax credit round. We started. We're starting that process now in terms of review. I don't know. Ann, can you just provide a quick update in terms of the schedule? We're looking to have recommendations to the board in May, but can we just run over the quick schedule? How are we going to get there?
Sure. Good morning, everybody. This is Ann Berman. So we received the applications on December 18th. Staff has been well into their review. We've got deficiency notices, deficiency/clarification notices went out January 8th, so that was last Friday. We give folks 2 weeks to submit, things that we've identified as missing from their application. Beginning late January into the first couple of weeks of February, we'll do our presentation where we offer the applicants an opportunity to make a presentation. It will be very structured. We'll do it obviously through video conference. We'll provide some questions ahead of time. Everybody will have a standard agenda. We'll try and keep it, to about 55 minutes. By the beginning of March, we should be ready to make our threshold determinations. And as you recall, we have 5 threshold criteria in the QAP. If a project does not pass threshold, then it is not officially scored. Once we make those threshold determinations, we'll work through the rest of March to score the remaining applications, prepare our executive summaries, have we do offer an appeal period to applicants if they are concerned about the score we've given them. They can't appeal threshold, but they can appeal their score. That will bring us to, I would say, the first couple of weeks of of April, in which we'll schedule a call with Senior Funding Committee and somebody from the board to make the presentations, and that committee will then make recommendations for the award of credits, and from there we'll go to the credit committee and then the Board of Commissioners. And because of sort of those meetings, it'll take us to May to get to the board for firm approval, or preliminary approval, excuse me.
So we'll pause there, see if there are any questions regarding the tax credit round.
Eric, this is Nick, if I may. Put in context this year's proposals in terms of quality and quantity compared to last year. To say it's been a strange year will be an understatement. I'm curious what impact that is having, if any, on our proposals.
The proposals, I would say, the initial review, the quality of the proposals are probably much better than we've had in the past. It's going to be an extremely difficult process in terms of awarding the credits, and that's the position we want to be in terms of good proposals. We may have two or three transactions that do not meet threshold. We're going through that right now. Typically in the past we've had more transactions, so that speaks to the quality of the proposals. We've spent the last year or so really working with our partners and really around capacity and making sure that they understand the threshold criteria. And as a result, we've got much better proposals. James, Ann, and I have spent a lot of time in terms of working with our partners. I don't know if James or Ann want to add anything in terms of the quality of proposals. I know there were two other proposals that were coming up, but based on conversations that we have with them in terms of threshold and where they need to be, they decided not to submit their proposals.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good summary. I would just add to Eric's last point that, you know, we have spent some time reaching out to our partners and kind of working through the notion that submitting a poorly constructed or an unfinished application doesn't get you in the queue for future consideration. It just is a poor reflection on the industry as a whole, and it's not really useful. So we want to make sure that we work with folks to let them know exactly what we're expecting so they put their best foot forward, and we have a robust round every year. As Eric said, you know, I think this is a very the geographic spread of the proposals, as well as the broad range of developers, is a good sign for us moving forward. And the fact that clearly, you know, the message we're putting out there has been heard, because we've heard back from some of our partners that said, based on our conversations, we decided not to apply because we wanted to really fine-tune the application and make it the best one it could be. So I think it's a good harbinger for future rounds.
Are there many new applicants?
Yes, I was just going to give a quick rundown. Yes, we have Penrose is a new applicant for us. We have a new firm out of Boston, Caribbean Integration. Hawking is fairly new. They've been around, but they a long time ago. They haven't been a participant for several years. So. And also, we have a new joint venture that's proposing Hope Mill Village. It's with a group based out of Connecticut. So, and also the breakdown here, we have, I'm just looking at it, we have three transactions with nonprofits, and the remaining eight are with for-profit developers.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I think this is Commissioner Arthur. Eric, if you could just move on to Lippitt Mill and Barbara Jordan.
So in terms of Barbara Jordan is one of the transactions part of the tax credit. So we're going through that proposal now. As many of you know, that's a joint venture between Omni, Rhode Island, and Wingate. So we're reviewing that proposal. The only other thing I would add in terms of Barbara joining at this particular time is that we have a fully executed purchase and sell with Omni Wingate. If I recall correct, Nicole, correct me if I'm misspeaking, but the purchase and sell, they had to acquire it 60 days after the awards of tax credits. Is that correct, Nicole?
I believe that's correct. I do not have the P&S in front of me, but I believe that's correct, Eric.
It's so, a little premature, obviously, but how are they looking on the 9%?
I think it's too early at this point to tell. We're still working through that review, Kevin.
Okay. But it was a solid, credible application.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. In terms of Lipit, I'll turn it over to Ann to lead the discussion. Ann?
Sure. Good morning, everybody. This is Ann Berman. So just by way of a quick recap, because it's been a while since we've talked about this, Lipit Mill is a 65-unit multifamily project located in West Warwick. The original financing plan called for 28 affordable and 37 market rate units. The project closed in December of 2017. The developer is Pawtucket Development, which is an entity controlled by Chris Shaw and Juan Valerino, who is the guarantor. It was a back-to-back tax-exempt loan with Citizens Bank as the construction lender. And the original closing included a forward commitment from Freddie Mac, for the permanent loan. As you recall, work was halted in the fourth quarter of 2019 due to cost overruns. Citizens has been extending the note maturity over the past 12 months as the borrower has attempted to identify additional resources to complete the project. Because the project was not placed in service by 12/28 of 2020, the borrower is no longer eligible for an allocation of low-income housing tax credits under the original bond issuance, which we'll talk about in a second. In regard to project status, the current cost overruns are estimated to be about $3.5 million. They're due primarily to structural deficiencies and historic compliance. Overall, the developer it is anticipated that the developer's sponsor loan to the project will be north of $5 million. The borrower and the general contractor, who was March Associates, have not been able to reach an agreement on overdue requisitions, including retainage, cost to complete, schedule to complete. So subsequently, the borrower and March are currently engaged in a lawsuit, and that process is proceeding. Recently, borrower engaged Parasol Builders to prepare a detailed plan and cost estimate for completing the building. Parasol is a Rhode Island-based firm that has worked on previous Rhode Island housing finance projects. Parasol's proposal is due in mid-January. They have intimated that they intend to retain many of the original subcontractors, which will lessen March's claim as it relates to the retainage that has been withheld. The borrower has reached out to Rhode Island Housing regarding their eligibility for additional volume cap. Again, we'll talk about that in a second, to facilitate the allocation of 4% tax credits, which are pretty integral to getting the project completed. We have communicated the importance of compliance with the QAP, particularly regarding developer capacity. We did this as recently as yesterday, again. Borrower has communicated that they intend to identify a partner with LIHTC experience who will be the managing partner. And both our staff and Citizens have reached out to colleagues in Pennsylvania regarding the proposed development partner. So we're still getting some detail on that. the increase in the 4% credit will help the project bridge some of the cost overruns. And obviously we're waiting for some additional information on that. The current original federal historic tax credit investor wants to exit the partnership and be repaid for their capital invested at closing, and that exit will likely occur as part of a subsequent transaction. The anticipated capital stack to complete the project includes the following. So a first mortgage, LIHTC equity, federal historic tax credit equity, state historic tax credit equity, rebuild credits, a sponsor, unsecured loan, and a deferred developer fee. The anticipated number of LIHTC units upon completion will be 45, which is up from the original plan of 28. Citizens has, in December, they moved this project into their workout division, and they continue to monitor the financial strength of the guarantor. In regard to the bonds, the borrower, as I mentioned before, failed to place the project in service, eliminating their eligibility for an allocation of 4% tax credits. Per bond counsel, and we've had many conversations with bond counsel recently, any extensions beyond 12/28/2020, which was 36 months after the initial issuance, triggers a reissuance of the bonds. Each reissuance of the bonds comes with requirements for a bond opinion, updated 95-5s, other diligence and certifications, all of which are quite expensive. And so multiple extensions would result in multiple reissuances. As a result of the cost associated with a reissuance, Citizens determined that the most expedient course of action was to convert the tax-exempt bonds to taxable bonds, thereby eliminating the need for one or more reissuances. And this was done in consultation with bond counsel. This conversion to taxable was done as part of the fifth extension to the note executed in late December, pushing the loan maturity to December 2021. As part of this extension, the balance of the unused bond proceeds, which was approximately $1.5 million, was drawn and deposited into a fully restricted account held by Citizens. And this deems the original $9 million bonds as fully funded. When the borrower develops their new plan for completing the project, including but not limited to a new budget, new partners, commitment for a new back-to-back from Citizens or another lender, firm commitments from a permanent lender and syndicators, the borrower will ask Rhode Island Housing to issue new volume cap, which will result in a second bond issuance, the proceeds of which will repay the initial initial loan and again make the project eligible for an allocation of LIHTC and the equity that will be generated. That was a lot of information. So let me know if anybody has any questions. And I know Nicole is very attuned to sort of the bond related questions. So she or Kara may be able to provide more detail if you have questions.
Commissioner Orth, a little hesitant to jump in there. I know there's a ton of details, and thank you for providing that recap. And I guess maybe Nicole, distill it down, and what is the outside housing in our state that we want to see finished, and you know the work that will be required to get there. What about just the overall, I guess, liability to Rhode Island Housing? I know it was Citizens, it was a back-to-back structure, so we weren't involved. Well, we weren't the lender, but maybe just briefly say what the impact to us is on this transaction.
So the good thing about this type of transaction, the back-to-back transaction, is one of the reasons why it was an arrangement that was beneficial to Rhode Island Housing is the limitation on our liability. So being in this type of transaction, we actually assign all of our rights and liability to the purchaser of the bond, and they take on the obligation and the risk related to the repayment of the debt. So our liability is not a financial liability, it's a reputational risk, not to say that doesn't have its own issues, but it's more reputational. In this case, though, we do have some financial risk in the sense that we are generating legal fees and other sorts of fees with the extension of this matter not being resolved. So we don't have a financial risk. The risk is with citizens, but we do have a reputational risk, and we do have some minimal financial related risk related to fees. We also, the flip side to this is we have limited ability to kind of move this project without citizens taking the lead. As I said, we have assigned our risk and rights underneath the loan document, so we really have to follow citizens' lead in terms of how they want to handle this developer, whether they want to foreclose or whether they choose to kind of wait it out and see if they're able to adjust things and move it forward. So the good is that our risk is minimal. The bad part is that we get taken along for the ride.
Understood. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions or comments about pipeline report before we move on?
Oh, hey, Kevin, it's Maria. I just had a quick question for Anne. Just back to the beginning of this, what did you say the main reasons were for the significant delays? Sorry, I missed that.
No, that's okay. You know, structural deficiencies and historic compliance. I would say that one of the, hindsight's always 20/20, right? and if we could wind the clock back, you know, almost 4 years at this point, I think one of the challenges here was that it was, this was a design build project. And I just think that there was not enough due diligence done by the developer and the architect and perhaps citizens as the lender as well. At the beginning, I think a little bit more focus on the plans and specs would have gone a long way. That being said, this is the oldest wooden mill in the state of Rhode Island, and it's sort of comprised of three buildings, and one of the mills just turned out to be unsalvageable. So they basically had to tear it down and rebuild it. So they lost some historic credits, plus it just got very expensive. So, other than the structural deficiencies and the historic compliance, I also just think it's, the initial execution perhaps was a little underestimated.
Okay, yeah, thanks. That helped clarify. It sounds like a very complicated deal, and then a couple things didn't go quite right. And okay, mm-hmm. Makes sense. Thank you.
I hear no other comments. Let's thank you all for that. Let's move to the discussion item two, which is an update on the Workforce Housing Initiative. I think, Eric, you're going to lead us in this one as well.
Yes.
Eric.
Yes.
Commissioner Walsh, it's Carol Ventura. Liz Tanner had to jump off the call, so she's no longer participating in the meeting. She's going to try to come back, but she's dealing with an issue. So, okay.
Okay. Thanks.
Great. Okay. In terms of the workforce housing, our initial program, 2019 Workforce Innovation Program, we funded two projects, Parcel 6 and West Fallon Street. Both of those transactions are under construction. We're slated to close this month on both transactions. So they started with the construction without our funds. So both of those are moving forward, and like I said, we're slated to close by the end of this month. Fountain Street, we're anticipating the 23rd, I believe, and then by the end of this month for Parcel 6.
That's great to hear. I saw some construction activity there at Parcel 6, and I was just hoping it was the project that we funded. So any major, I don't know, changes to the project since we approved it to speak of?
There hasn't been any major. Anne's closer to the the transaction as we're getting closer to, but I'm not aware. And are there any, it hasn't been any major changes, correct?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I would say the sort of the two differences between the two projects is on West Fountain Street, the workforce housing money is actually going to go into the project when the project is fully completed. And on parcel 6, it will go in on a pari passu basis, which, you know, kind of there's a little bit more due diligence that needs to be undertaken when we're part of the construction financing, as opposed to once it gets its CO.
All right, understood. Okay, great.
Sure. So also, Kevin, hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. So we currently have an RFP out on the street now for a little over $8 million in workforce funding. Applications are due on March 5th.
And any changes to the program as presented in that RFP?
We tweaked just clarification items, no major changes from it. Just from the feedback we got, we just clarified a few things, but nothing major in terms of the program.
And what has been the industry feedback from, I guess, that first round and leading up to this RFP? What have you been hearing out there?
Very positive. And quite frankly, it was really waiting for some of these transactions to go through as sort of the guinea pigs. And so we've had a lot more conversations. So we're anticipating a lot more interest in the program. So we're excited to see what's going to happen in terms of March 5th, a number of conversations. I would say some of the feedback was from the community was really, would we provide kind of a preservation or a deal that has already a refinance, I should say. And so looking at the regs, there isn't anything that precludes us from doing that. So I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we got a couple of transactions that are looking to refinance and make some of those units workforce that are currently at market rate units now.
Okay, great. Any other questions about this program? Good. Hearing none, thanks for that update, Eric. And let's move on to the next item, which is an update on the acquisition and revitalization program.
Yes, I'll start, and Eric Alexander is on the line as well. We can chime in. So we have we had $10 million in ARP funding. All of the total $10 million has been committed. I'm hearing some background noise. Can you hear me, Kevin?
Yeah, it sounds like someone's dialing out. If you could mute your phone.
Okay. I'll start over. So we had $10 million in ARP funding. $10 million has been committed to projects. I'm just going to give you a breakout of those projects. Seven projects have been completed to date for $3.5 million in ARP funding. We have five projects closed under construction for another $2.6 million in ARP funding. And we have seven projects that are in the closing mode working towards that finish line for the remaining 3.7 in ARP financing. So again, the total award has been committed to date. Eric, I don't know if I missed anything. If you want to add, if any projects you you want to highlight?
I think just to provide a little bit more detail on the projects that remain open that we're closing, we've got closing pending on close to $2 million worth of projects in Q1. A few of the projects that are being held up, I just wanted to highlight. Millrace Commercial, that's a fairly significant allocation of $975,000. We're holding that while they complete the capital stack on the overall Millrace project at the request of Commerce. 54 Middle Street, which is a part of several five total homeownership units, two-family primarily, that PCFD is doing on Middle Street in Pawtucket. Four of those are in closing. One of them, 54 Middle Street, has title issues that they're working through with the city. They need to get clearance in Superior Court, and it's going to be about 6 months at least before that's finalized. But the balance of the Middle Street properties are proceeding. The final is 390 Pine Street, which we're working with them on resolving some final issues and hope to be moving to closing on that project shortly as well.
This is Commissioner Orth. I'm happy to hear that it sounds like almost all of these projects have either been completed or are well underway. And just on a personal note, I love the Farm Fresh project out of West End. I mean, that's just a great place to have a winter's farmers market and community gathering, and just to kind of continue the rebirth of that area over there. What could you just offer maybe some observations looking back at this program, and was it a good use of that money, or kind of challenges, or and maybe some things to learn about it in a nutshell?
Eric, I'm happy to speak to that, and you can add if you have anything. I think one of the lessons that we've learned is that it's difficult, frankly, to have such disparate types of projects kind of competing in the same pool. So you have residential, commercial, and public facility proposals all competing for the same pot of money, and it has been a challenge to kind of devise a tool that can compare apples to oranges to bananas. That being said, I think that we ultimately ended up in a place where we were able to fairly successfully do that. You know, to kind of echo your personal note about Farm Fresh, it's been a very gratifying program, I think, for staff, because we have gotten to see again that wide variety of projects that we don't typically see because we obviously focus on residential. So it's been very satisfying to be able to participate in this program and look at projects that impact neighborhoods holistically.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that, and just to underscore something you just said, Eric, in terms of holistically, you look at some of the projects that are completed, and typically we wouldn't have a opportunity in our typical toolkit to participate in. So you say Farm Fresh is a great project that emphasizes that, but also the Dexter Adult Learning Center in Central Falls, outstanding project that just having such a major impact on that community in terms of drive training and self-sufficiency, able to participate on that project through the ARC funds. 404 Broad Street, Southside Community Land Trust, also just a stellar project that's having a major impact in the community. These are projects typically we wouldn't be able to invest in, and through these resources we have been able to. So it's been really rewarding from that perspective.
Great, thank you all very much. Maria or Nick, any comments or questions about this program?
None for me.
Okay.
No, I'm good.
Okay, great. Thank you, Eric. Both Erics. Let's move on to discussion item number four, which is I had asked to include this item, which is trying to increase our multifamily production, looking back at this past year. And I believe it was, Eric, correct me, but I believe maybe only 1%, 4% deal. Happy to hear that we've got potentially 4 to 5 right now in the queue.
Right.
But with the fixing of the 4% credit, we had we received a lot of capital magnet funding, and and potentially another bond, affordable housing bond, coming down the pike. So it looks like we'll have a fair amount of resources. So I just wanted to kind of chat about that and see how we could really effectively put those to use. And I know that Maria, you've got the experience across the country with states grappling with how do we use this 4% program more effectively. So I'd love to get your take on this as well. Eric, if you'd like to kind of lead the discussion, please.
Yeah, I sort of open this up for like free for all, in terms of, James, Eric, as well as Ann. It's something that we talk about all the time in terms of kind of pipeline and how we can increase our production. So in terms of production per se, we don't have a real issue in terms of identifying kind of pipeline. It's really about executing, right? And how do we expedite that process in terms of getting folks from preliminary to actually closing. The sourcing, obviously we continue to do that. Some of the things that we're doing, we meet every Thursday morning to just dedicated to business development. And one of the things we're trying to do is really look at how we source and transaction, how do we get the word out. And so what we're trying to do is really make sure that we keep the phones ringing. So we try to stagger some of these RFPs out so we keep folks calling and communicating with us. So we had the tax credit round. Obviously, that RFA went out. Then we had the workforce. We're also going to have a HIF round and a zeros round that's coming up in February. So we just constantly keep the phones ringing and reaching out. We work very closely with our asset management group to once they identify projects that, that may have issues. And so the development team kind of reaches out to those development partners. We really focus on projects that are getting closer to their 15-year compliance period, and kind of work backwards from there to see if they're eligible for refinancing. Then we work with our finance group to see if we could put together a package. So we're constantly looking and sourcing, and given the resources that we have now. Again, I think it speaks to some of what I spoke about earlier in terms of where that pipeline is, in terms of the 4%. I think we'll have more just given the additional equity there. We'll have more opportunities to execute on those type of transactions. James, and I don't know if you guys had anything.
I would. I mean, I think prior, as a former developer, there was a perception that you couldn't do a 4% new construction deal in Rhode Island because there just wasn't the ancillary financing in great enough numbers to support the gap you'd need to fill. And, I know that on both sides of the transaction I'm familiar with Pineview last year, it was a lift, but it was something that I think the development staff was committed to doing and demonstrating that we could achieve, given the resources available, and that's worked out very well. But also, the resources have expanded. If we do get an extra bond, another bond, that will be really instrumental. And the 4% credit fix that occurred as part of the omnibus bill that was just passed in Congress a couple weeks ago is an enormous boon to these type of transactions. With the Pineview deal, that I was talking about just before, it's going to end up realizing an extra $1 million or so in equity, which will then in turn reduce reliance upon other sources and let those go a little bit further. So it's, you know, it's a good climate to be doing the work that we're doing. And, you know, just to back up what Eric said, it's, you know, the team is constantly reaching out to try and figure out ways to get things done and working with our partners who may have thought it wasn't something that was possible in the past because of the resources. Now, by virtue of making some of our own resources available, leveraging some state resources, and going to be able to tap into the added equity from the credit rate fix, I think we'll see a lot more interest in this type of transaction because people will see it's actually possible. And, you know, as Pineview gets rolling, that'll be a concrete example of, look, we did this. It requires some work, but we can make this happen. So I'm pretty excited to see how this is going to expand over the next year.
Yeah, and this is Ann. I think Eric and James have stated it really well. And I would just add a couple of other points. We are actually going in the midst of a bond issuance this month, and we have three tax-exempt deals that are included in that, two that closed last year and one that is closing in the next couple of weeks. The interesting thing about some of our preservation transactions, you know, because we've also released the sort of the new preservation funds, is folks are really looking. I've had multiple conversations with some of our nonprofit developers who are, you know, weighing options for their projects and recognizing that, you know, they can preserve the development and may not need to go through a 4% transaction, which, you know, for some of these preservation deals, that 4% is really critical. And in others, it may be less critical, and it adds a lot of cost and a lot of complication to it. So I think they're, not every deal is ripe for a 4% transaction. So I think folks are looking at that and trying to really, you know, look at lessons learned from previous transactions and figure out what's the best way for them to execute a transaction for their portfolio. You know, just to echo James, we are super excited about the 4%. That was a great holiday present for us.
Right. So, but to that point, when we're talking about transactions, where we're trying to simplify the execution, where it isn't a 4% execution, the Capital Magnet was a great source to kind of bridge that gap. Fortunately and unfortunately, next month, we have two transactions that we are slated to bring to the board for approval that will complete the $6.4 million in the 2018 Capital Magnet Award. So we won't have that resource available to us for those type of transactions. It's a good thing that we've met our obligations under our award, but again, it's not something that we have. We are waiting to hear from the next, the NOFR for the next round. But those monies have been expended as of next month.
Eric, this is Nick. It's very impressive the focus and attention you're giving to increasing production. I compliment all of you. Talk a little bit, just a moment or two, about how we reach out, how we interact, how we talk with our partners and our potential partners. How do we learn from them as well as from ourselves?
So, I mean, we do it in a variety of ways. That, you know, we meet with the housing network on a quarterly basis as a staff to kind of hear from them, the membership, and how we can help, what they need in terms of resources. James is probably meeting with them on a weekly basis and giving us feedback from there. We're constantly reaching out to property owners and having conversations with them through relationships and just, again, reaching out. Like I mentioned earlier, we meet every Thursday morning to talk about kind of business development and how we reach out and to whom we should be reaching out to. And we kind of divide and conquer and utilizing our team. Historically, was really kind of myself and Ann soliciting, and we've moved away from that model and really take advantage of our DOs and everyone on staff to build those relationships and hear and get feedback from them, their contacts, and try to design programs around that. So it's just constantly touching our borrowers and really listening.
Thank you.
Hey, Kevin, I'll jump in. I think the team did a great job describing the opportunities. And, you know, I would just echo the fact that I think this is really good in that, you know, more subsidy is just helpful and so needed on these 4% deals. And also the really knowing what you're getting now versus the rate moving and then, you know, trying to figure out where you're actually going to land. Particularly in this low interest rate environment. So I think it's all good. There certainly is, as the team mentioned, the need for additional subsidy, and that, you know, 4%, even though it's fixed now, won't be able to do it all. But you know, should get us about 30% more, I think, than proceeds. So it's definitely going to be a lift. And I think if we can cobble together the rest, it definitely should create some more opportunities in Rhode Island.
I agree. I think it's wonderful to see these resources coming. One of the items not mentioned is acquisition rehab and what role that might play. James, Eric, do you want to speak to that?
I'll defer to James. I know he's had multiple conversations with Commerce, and I know there's a number of things out there in terms of ACT rehab. So, James, I don't...
Yeah, I don't have a lot to say about it, Kevin. You know, it's certainly something we would be open to. I mean, I would like to do it on a different model than I just did with the acquisition of the homeless, the buildings we're using for homeless care over the winter. It's an interesting model, and it's not without its challenges. It's not something that we get often coming through the door in terms of projects, but it's not something we turn away either. I think, you know, like everything else, each deal is going to stand on its own, and we would look at a creative approach to doing anything. You know, we're in the production business, as you know, so I don't think we have any plans to model something right now, but we would certainly entertain any deal people brought in to talk about.
Okay. Do we have a sense of how the governor or legislature might want to see the potential bond funds utilized?
Kevin, this is Carol. I think that there's an outline that was created early on by Commerce that had various programs that kind of came together with meetings with a lot of stakeholders throughout the state. And that included, you know, the typical construction and rehab programs, a program to potentially enroll in affordable units by working with private landlords to rehab their properties. And then there was a site control type of product that look not only at acquisition, but also how to improve the site and make it ready for development. So there is a proposed memo outlining a number of different strategies for the bond. I think at the end of the day, it will broadly talk about providing affordable housing for low and moderate income Rhode Islanders on the ballot. And then once approved, I believe the buckets will be created, and I'm assuming that would be under the new administration. So what that looks like at that point, I don't know, but I'm assuming it would be heavily focused on our traditional process like building homes Rhode Island, acquisition, rehab, and construction.
Okay, and so do we have a seat at the table with those discussions?
Yes, we do. Yes, okay. Amy is participating right now as the bond ramps up and, you know, marketing and how it's messaged. And then the bond would likely go through, if it follows the same process, it would be under the auspices of the Housing Resources Commission. So they would weigh in heavily on what the activities would be under the bond. And I'm assuming that we would have an administrative role, as we've always had with previous housing bonds.
Okay, great.
Kevin, I just mentioned that Commissioner Tanner is back on.
Oh, great. Liz, we were just going over kind of the multifamily production and some of the resources, old resources, but also new resources that we have, particularly the fixing of a 4% credit and how we might make sure that we fully utilize those resources. Would you happen to have any comments or questions about that item?
None at this time. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Liz. Any other comments or questions before we move forward? Great. So the final one is just an update on multifamily delinquency and any information that we might have on potential tenant evictions. Thank you. Mike DiCiaro, Assistant Director of Development and Asset Management, will present this item, please.
Thank you, Kevin, and good morning, everyone. I'm just going to provide a brief overview of the multifamily lending portfolio, and then I'll turn it over to Leslie McKnight. She may have some comments on our single-family, on the single-family side of the shop. For multifamily, though, I'm pleased to report again that the multifamily loan portfolio finished 2020 with zero delinquencies. In fact, we've not experienced a 30-plus day delinquency on the multifamily side since the second quarter of 2019. So that's 18 months with no delinquent loans, which is fairly remarkable considering the challenges that 2020 presented. Kudos to Leslie and her staff in loan servicing, as well as staff in my department for their proactive communication, early outreach to sites. We would, you know, regularly check delinquency reports when a payment wasn't received in the first 10 or 15 days of the month. We run the phone with those owners and managers. So they did a great job in maintaining that zero delinquency. We're now beginning to receive 2020 financial statements. They'll come in over the next couple of months, and we'll begin to analyze that data. We should be able to formally report out on the 2020 actual performance by the late spring, early summer. It's still a very manual process for us. So we're very excited about completing our selection for a new development and asset management software product. We're in the final stages of that review process, and we'll hopefully be selecting a vendor in the next week or two. We'll be able to automate much of our asset management and compliance efforts, and our data will be closely linked with development and design and construction. We'll spend a lot more time analyzing data and less time with duplicative data entry. It's a large undertaking. I believe it may be the largest, and certainly one of the largest software implementations ever at Rhode Island Housing, but it's a very exciting project, and we're very much looking forward to the new efficiencies that the software will bring to us in our department. I do want to highlight a couple of data points that came out of our 2019 data. So I understand it's 2019, it was pre-pandemic. I think on a very high level, just to highlight a few things that I think reflect why our properties were able to weather the storm of 2020. The top of the list is debt coverage ratios. The average debt coverage ratio in our portfolio was 1.82, which is significant, fairly high, and reserves are still very well funded throughout the portfolio. Of the 211 audits that our staff reviewed in 2020, these were 2019 audits. 124 of those 211 developments realized surplus cash totaling over $26 million. Of that surplus cash, almost $1 million, about $850,000, went to pay Rhode Island Housing deferred debt, which is wonderful. Another $1.8 million went to the Affordable Housing Trust. These are both for AHT loan repayments as well as preservation fees. In fact, preservation fees were about $1.2 million in 2019 that we paid to the HT in 2020. So again, the portfolio was well positioned entering 2020. So looking at this past year and what we went through and our concerns and the workout conversations we had with owners. We never entered into any formal forbearance agreements, but we had conversations with many owners, and we were very flexible with our required reserve payments. In a few cases, we waived collecting on our deferred debt, provided that the owner agreed to allow surplus cash to remain in operations to help support the property, and that worked very well. I think we had 3 or 4 developments take advantage of that. We still have one property in forbearance. It's a fairly long-term pre-COVID issue, straight tax credit property, very small development. The owner is working on restructuring that deal, so we expect to see a new transaction with that property in the next, probably 12 months. I also wanted to note that another property that has been a very, very long-term forbearance, it's actually a property that's been under forbearance for almost 12 years of interest-only payments. We executed 18 separate forbearance agreements since March of 2009. The property actually is resuming or has resumed full P&I payments. You can ask me why, I'm sure. So as you all know, this is a West End Preservation. It's an older property, suffers some deferred maintenance issues. The manager do a great job of keeping it up. But they have an issue with residents at this property where they have a project-based voucher contract. And for some reason, this property is just ripe for folks taking the voucher after a year and porting out, getting a portable voucher. So the turnover expense of this property has been significant for many years. So the one advantage of folks staying in their house and staying in their units and not moving, the turnover expense went down significantly in 2020 on that property. So we're happy to report that they're resuming their full P&Is. The other concern that we've seen and we've been monitoring as closely as possible in the last 6 months has been tenant receivables. I think I reported on this previously, but tenant receivables, based on information we received from our properties, increased about 35% from the second to the third quarters of 2020. Again, this was not new tenants that were delinquent on their rent. It appeared to be roughly the same number of delinquent accounts, but the arrearage numbers were much more significant. So folks were staying in their units, either because of the eviction moratorium or owners willing to work, enter into workout agreements with folks. The number of the arrearage dollars has been going up significantly. Our fourth quarter financials are just starting to trickle in now, so I don't have the numbers to share today to show where those accounts receivable numbers are. But I wanted to report on some housing help rental assistance numbers that have had or are having a very significant impact on our portfolio. Based on the most recent report I looked at last night, about a little more than $600,000 have been dispersed to landlords of affordable housing developments throughout the state. And I believe the funds only started rolling out in late November, early December. So in a very short period of time, the team mobilized it and got a lot of money out the door. I went through the properties that this money has gone to, and more than $500,000 has gone into 56 properties that are in our finance portfolio. So it's an incredible impact. For comparison, our entire portfolio, the third quarter accounts receivable, not just tenant accounts receivable, but vendors as well, was a little bit over $2 million. So $500,000 infused to 30% of our portfolio, certainly making a tremendous impact, not only on the operations of these sites, but certainly the stability that it's provided to the residents. Again, last night, my count looked like 411 households have been assisted to date under that program. So wonderful to be able to report that. And as soon as we have the fourth quarter numbers, we can confirm what that influx of cash did to our portfolio. We'll report out on that. I also wanted to provide a quick update on pending evictions. We pulled some data from district court and found that there are currently 655 eviction actions throughout the state that are pending hearing. I went through the list of plaintiffs in these cases, and it's again, a manual process, and the court doesn't provide a whole lot of detail. Some owners and management companies are grouped together, so it's challenging to figure out which properties might be in our portfolio. But my best estimate is that only about maybe 50 or 60 cases of the 655 appear to be from Rhode Island Housing Finance properties. So between the assistance our sites have been receiving under the Housing Help Program, and in these numbers that are reported by the courts, I don't expect to see a significant number of evictions, at least for the next 90 to 120 days. It's ever changing, so we'll certainly closely monitor eviction activity going forward and adjust and look to help any way we can to stabilize property. So from my perspective, it's all good news at this point. Again, we're always cautious. We're always trying to be proactive and be prepared for what's around the corner. But as of right now, everything looks good on our end. Anyone have any questions?
I appreciate that summary, Mike. That was outstanding and all very, very positive news.
Thanks. Yeah, and Liz, I don't know if you're on, if you want to write a single family update.
Sure. I will make this brief. On the single family side, we ended December 2020 with a delinquency rate of 16.14%. That's an increase of 52 basis points over November. Of the delinquent borrowers from month end December 2020, 67% were borrowers who are currently in a COVID forbearance. We've had a total of 2,016 borrowers request COVID forbearance since March, and we have 1,312 borrowers who remain in forbearance, of which just over 64% are borrowers who have been in forbearance for four or more payments. We've had 58 Rhode Island housing borrowers receive or have been approved for hardest hit fund payment assistance, totaling just over $485,000, and there are an additional 8 applications that are under review. We have 371 borrowers who are scheduled to end their 12-month COVID forbearance plans as of March 1st of 2021. We're currently doing outreach to those borrowers to inform them of what their options are post-forbearance. FHA has extended their deadline to request an initial COVID forbearance application through February 28, 2021, and they've also extended their foreclosure and eviction moratoriums until February 28, 2021. FHFA, who provides oversight to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, has announced an extension of foreclosure and eviction moratoriums through January 31st of 2021. So those are the brief highlights regarding the single family portfolio.
Great, thank you very much, Leslie. Any questions, comments?
The only comment I would make is Leslie and his team do a great job in terms of the delinquencies and watching some of the major trends. I meet with them monthly just to monitor it to make sure we're not surprised by any data, and they do give a full and full report on situation.
Great. Thank you. Hearing no other comments or questions, I'd just like to wrap up our meeting. Do we need to do a roll call vote on
Commissioner Orr? Chairman Retsinas asked that we add discussion of broadband to the agenda today. So if we could
certainly
do that.
Yep.
Nicole, do we need a vote on that?
Nope, I think that if the committee chairman Orth can just ask the committee members if that's okay, I think a voice vote is acceptable.
Is it all right with everyone to have a discussion on broadband internet access?
Sure.
Okay, great.
I'll take that as a yes. let me update everyone on the status of our research into broadband. I have Amy on the line as well. She and her team and certainly Christine have been doing a lot of work on this. We have been working closely with Cox Communications, and they should have information for us by the end of the week on the connectivity status of our developments and the cost of wiring those that don't currently offer broadband infrastructure on site. We have a meeting with them scheduled for January 20th to discuss the various options we have. And then we hope that they'll be able to share some information on the COVID broadband dollars that should be flowing into the state of Rhode Island shortly, how that's going to be deployed, and how we can potentially partner with them to use those resources for affordable housing developments. We do intend to meet with staff in the governor's office that are working on broadband initiatives. As you might imagine, right now it's a little busy and hectic up at the State House, so I think once the new governor comes on board and things settle down, we should be able to convene a meeting with the folks that are leading the broadband initiative for the state. James Comer and Stacey Wasserman and the team over in Amy's shop are working on a request for proposals for the $250,000 that the board approved in the program budget. And last week, an intern from Brown's Capstone program began a research project for us to look at best practices for building non-financial elements into our QAP. And internet access is going to be part of that review. The project, the write-up on that project should be complete by March. Amy or James, anything further you want to add to this update?
No, just that we've reached out to the Housing Network just to get some ideas about things that they'd be interested in doing to help inform how we're crafting the RFP. And it seems, you know, right now everyone, with the exception of one neighborhood builders who are working on their own network in Olneyville, are interested and support the idea but don't have concrete ideas yet as to how they would deploy the money. So, but it's a good conversation to have started and people are really engaged around it.
That's a great overview.
This is Amy. I would just add that we actually were able to get a meeting with the folks in the governor's office for next week. So we'll get an early sense from them, I think, in terms of what they're thinking in terms of the broadband funding deployment, and certainly the new governor may have other thoughts in terms of that direction.
And on a national level, right now all of the housing finance agencies across the country are really focused on the rental assistance dollars that are going to be coming into the state and trying to come up with design ideas about how those funds are deployed. It may be that this becomes a larger topic for HFEs once we move beyond this initial influx of money that's coming in for rental assistance.
Carol, this is Liz Tanner. I just wanted to mention that we should probably take some of this offline because we are at Commerce and DVR working on a proposal with the Office of Innovation as well on broadband, so it's something we should try to coordinate some efforts on.
Excellent. That's great to hear. Amy, is that who you're meeting with, the Office of Innovation?
It's folks in the Commerce office and in the Governor's office immediate staff that have been involved in the broadband initiative.
Great. Okay. Yeah, thank you for that, Liz. We'll definitely reach out and connect on this.
This is Nick. I just want to thank Carol and her team for moving forward on this. This was just a gleam in my eye a while back, and to see it start to blossom is very important. I do believe the digital divide between poor people and not poor people is pretty wide, and lack of consistent access to broadband is one part of that. So I'm pleased. So there was an interesting, Carol, about a month ago, NCSHA and its Friday editorial had a section just on broadband. That
yes.
might be interesting to the staff, to give them some idea that we're not alone in this.
Yeah, thank you.
And Kevin, thank you for coming to those meetings.
Oh, certainly, my pleasure. Spurred me on a little bit, Nick, to take a look at a deeper look at my own portfolio, so that's been good.
Good. That's a good thing.
Good. Assuming there's no other business, I'd like to request a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second, Liz Tanner.
Second, great. And Nicole, then, could you please call for a roll call?
Thank you, Commissioner. This is Nicole Clement. When I call your name, if you are in favor of adjourning this meeting, please respond by saying aye or opposed by saying nay. Committee Chairman Orth?
Aye.
Chairman Rezinas?
Aye.
Commissioner Tanner?
Aye.
Commissioner Barry?
Aye.
The vote is unanimous. The motion passes. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Nicole, and thank you, everyone, for your participation today. Hope you all have a great week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.